A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. So I know I said yesterday that Professor David Yamane was going to be with us on the show. Unfortunately, a bit of a conflict there with Professor Yamane's schedule. So he will be with us at some point in the near future, hopefully. But instead, we're going to be talking with Stephen Katowski, founder of The Reload. And we've got a lot to talk about. After more than a month of waiting here, you know, Donald Trump had issued a Second Amendment executive action directing the Attorney General to take a look at all of the policies and procedures and rules that could impact our right to keep and bear arms in federal agencies. We were starting to see the fruits of those endeavors, right? So the original deadline passed, and we learned that the Attorney General had been given basically a week-long extension. And then we've seen a couple of developments here, right? So we had the webpage from former Attorney General Vivek Murthy declaring gun violence a public health emergency. That was taken down from the Department of Health and Human Services. And then just I guess it was, I found out about it yesterday, but I guess it technically came out on Tuesday. This proposed rule from Attorney General Pam Bondi to reestablish this federal process by which individuals who've lost their right to keep and bear arms can have those rights restored. Also, I think I wouldn't put this in terms of a direct result of Trump's Second Amendment executive action, but I think within that same sphere, you also have the appointment of Professor Robert Leiter as the ATF's general counsel. A lot of folks may not know who Robert Leiter is, but he is a Second Amendment scholar and one who whose research has at least led him to conclude or at least at the very least supports the idea of a robust right to keep and bear arms. So you've got, you know, Second Amendment groups who are cheering Professor Leiter's appointment as the ATF general counsel. And I do think that's going to be a tremendous move. And it is, I think, a 180 degree move away from the anti-gun whole of government attacks on the firearms industry that we saw during the Biden administration. So we're going to talk about all of that with Stephen Katowski, the founder of The Reload. Take a look and a listen. Steve, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Absolutely.
And we are finally starting to get some news about the impact of Trump's Second Amendment executive order here this week, which is good. The deadline went by, was extended to last Sunday. And then, you know, we're kind of waiting to see if anything would happen this week. And we've got a couple of bits of news from DOJ and ATF. We'll talk about that proposed rule that Attorney General Pam Bondi introduced. I guess it's now officially published in the Federal Register, right? So this is officially underway. But the other big news, so a few weeks ago, the ATF's general counsel was dismissed. Now it looks like we've got a replacement and one that gun owners and Second Amendment groups are cheering. Robert Leiter, who is, I guess now, well, as of yesterday anyway, a law professor at George Mason University, a professor who has written extensively on Second Amendment issues and has come down, you know, in favor of a robust right to keep and bear arms. He's now going to be the top attorney at the ATF, right?
That's right. Yeah. And actually still finishing up his last semester. So he's doing both right now, as far as I understand it, which must be a lot of work for him. But yes, he's I would think it's fair to call him a gun rights advocate, not necessarily an activist, or he doesn't work for any gun control group, but he's a Second Amendment scholar. And I think also more importantly, a regulatory expert, somebody who understands how the ATF works. I don't know if you've interviewed me before, but he's been on my show a couple of times, including after Trump won the election, talking about what the best path forward for the ATF would look like. And he's been an advocate for keeping the ATF because there was a big, you know, there's a debate over what to do with it. Should they try to, dismantle it or merge it with the FBI or something, or try to work within the current structure to do stuff that gun rights activists would like to see done. And he was on the latter side of that. He wants to work through the regulatory process. And so his appointment is probably a sign that they're going to do that.
And you know, again, I mean, the whole debate about whether to, you know, close the ATF, shut it down completely, transfer its responsibilities over to Treasury. You know, what is it that he said, if you can recall, as to why it was better to keep the ATF open and to reform from within rather than to, you know, scrap it completely and build anew in another department?
Yeah, he had a couple of different arguments. On the one hand, some of them are practical, like if you just defunded the ATF or you just like fired all the agents or something like that. The problem is that the laws would still be there and they would still be in effect. And you can't get rid of the gun laws by just getting rid of the ATF. You have to go and change the statutes. But that's what a lot of people don't like the ATF. What they really don't like is the gun laws behind, you know, the enforcement. Now, there is obviously legitimate complaints about how the ATF has enforced things at times as well, but a lot of the complaints boil down to like, I don't like some of these restrictions that they're in charge of enforcing. And the problem is just getting rid of the ATF doesn't get rid of the restrictions. And then that would fall to somebody else in the federal government, probably the FBI. And the problem with the FBI enforcing the gun laws is one, they don't have the same level of expertise or understanding of it, the same history of doing it, which could lead to mistakes. But also, the FBI tends to take a much more aggressive approach to federal law enforcement than even the ITF does, and so that was another concern. And so, you know, if legislation is unlikely, which I think we would agree it is at this point, you know, major reform to federal gun laws is probably not going to happen with the majorities as they exist today. Then you're probably better off having somebody who understands how the regulatory process works at the ATF, and using that process to try and reform the agency to be less obtrusive on, you know, regular gun owners. And so, you know, you saw this put to the other direction with really the last. Since the bump stock ban through the Biden administration, where they did a number of rules using, you know, through the ATF to try and restrict gun ownership, you could do the opposite of that. Not just repeal the law, the ones that exist, the rules that have been made over the last several years, but also go in and try to propose new rules that change how the ATF enforces some of these laws.
Yeah, and that's going to be really interesting because so this brings us to the proposed rule that Pam Bondi submitted a couple days ago and has now again been published in the Federal Register. Were you surprised? I mean, we saw this story from the New York Times, was it last week, talking about the U.S. attorney or the DOJ attorney, excuse me, who resigned or was walked out after refusing to go along, she said, with this, you know, rights restoration process, which she said, you know, was going to be automated. That's not what the proposed rule says, by the way, right? What does the proposed rule say in terms of reestablishing this federal process by which people can have their rights restored?
Yeah, so I mean, I would describe the rule that they posted, that they published today, and is technically gone and into effect immediately, is kind of a plan to have a plan. That's kind of how, you know, if you read the full text of it, that's what it strikes me as. It's identifying a real problem, right? The problem is, federal law actually has a process, or has the attorney general technically has the authority to restore somebody's gun rights after they've served their time. You know, the discretion is up to the attorney general. Now, decades ago, this authority was delegated to the ATF, and they used to have a process that you could go through. You could apply to have your rights restored, and you'd go through this process that they created. And at the end of it, you know, if you met the criteria, you could have your rights restored. However, in the 90s and 1992 specifically, that was sort of at the height of the crime wave, and there was a lot of like crackdown on crime. You know, the crime bill was around that time as well, and there was outrage in Congress. I actually think Chuck Schumer was the guy who proposed this at the time, but there was outrage at how much money and time, manpower they were spending on this rights restoration process, claiming that some of these people who had their rights restored went on to commit gun crimes in the future. I don't have the data on this.
Mm-hmm.
It's from, you know, over 30 years ago. So I don't know
the numbers. I think the Violence Policy Center was like was behind that, too. Like, you know, coming up with a list of people that had their rights restored and then later went on to commit other crimes.
Sure. So like, I'm sure it happened. I don't know how common it was for that to happen.
Right.
And whether it was a real problem or not. Either way. You know, I just haven't done the, I don't have the historical data on that, but that was the issue that Congress pointed to when they decided to restrict funding to the ATF for this restoration process. And so basically the ATF can't spend allocated money on this process that exists. And
right.
It's under federal law. You can have your rights restored. It's just that the last 30 years, the process to do that has been defunded. So it hasn't happened. And so what they're doing here with this first, it's kind of a first step.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking back the delegation of authority from the ATF because there's legislation in the budget that says you ATF can't do this. So they're saying, all right, well, we're going to take it back to the Attorney General. And then we're going to come up with a plan for how we're going to use this authority at some point down the road. They talk about including, you know, basically in the president's budget that he proposes his sort of advice to Congress on what he wants to see them do. They're going to put language in there about this. They don't have it yet. This is sort of a promise to do that
right
down the line. And then they just kind of talk about, and they also say they're not going to delegate this authority to another agency at this point today. And they're just going to come up with a process that, you know, restores rights for people who they think are good candidates for this and who won't recommit or don't have maybe a history of violence. It doesn't get very deep into it. Doesn't get into specifics at all. The New York Times story is probably the best guide you have. Of course, that's about the internal debate over what they should do.
Right. And it sounds like it still very much is a debate, right? I know that the attorney who spoke to the Times claimed that there was going to be some sort of automated process.
Yeah, there seemed to be two disputes, right? There was she was opposed to the idea of having a more automated process for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And want to do a more case by case review. And then the other thing was over Mel Gibson got inserted into this at one point, and she didn't want to recommend that he get his gun rights back because he had a domestic violence conviction. So, those seem to be the two sticking points for her, at least.
Yeah. And I mean, and if you look at this proposed rule, it mentions, I think, on two, maybe three different occasions that the goal is to still keep violent offenders, those that pose a risk, prohibited persons, right? So, I know that the gun control groups were out there saying, oh my God, we're going to give guns back to violent felons. That does not seem to be the intent of the rule. In fact, far from it. So, again, as you say, I think it is fair to call it a plan for a plan. Yeah. So we do still need to see some specifics here. Were you surprised that this is the area that was the first proposed rule and not proposing simply rolling back all of the Biden era rules that were put in place regarding, because I mean, some of these things, obviously all of them are undergoing legal challenges right now. And there have been injunctions that have halted enforcement of, I would say, most of these rules to one degree or another, right? If you are a member of one of these challenged organizations like a GOA, you're exempt from some of the, like, I think it's the engaged in the business rule, right? You're exempt from following that. But still, it did kind of surprise me that this was the area that was the focus of the first proposed order from the Attorney General, and not simply saying, everything that Biden did over the last 4 years, we're going to roll that back.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit surprised. This was not necessarily the top of everyone's list of what they want to see done through rulemaking. I mean, this has been, to be clear, this has been a priority for gun rights groups in their lawsuits, right? There's some of the probably their best plaintiffs, your best test cases are in this realm where we're mm-hmm. talking about like nonviolent felons.
Brian Range, for example, right?
Who lied on a form to get food stamps in the 90s and hasn't been able to own guns ever since. That's pretty your ideal test case for this issue. And then actually, I think that Maybe we'll get into it a little bit, but or we could do it on my show when you're on my show. But you know, there's definitely a strategic question with the what they're doing here, because it could undermine some of those cases in theory, depending on how they do this. But yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that they didn't right away go and undo the, for instance, the zero tolerance policy, because that's not even a rule, right? Some of the other stuff. Some of this stuff is going to re require time, right? Undoing a lot of the actual rulemaking takes time. You know, the pistol brace rule probably take a year or so to actually undo that. Now they could have come out the gate with a proposal for a new rule, and they didn't do that. But you know, but I guess some of it you could, if you're being generous, right? You could say, well, they haven't had the team in place yet. They've clearly been focused on other things and pushing as hard as they can in a bunch of other areas. So this is one big takeaway has been this is a lower priority, but I've always tried to maintain that that doesn't mean they're not going to do these things. And so that's where, like, even this is not a huge announcement, right? This is a one relatively minor step, but that's something. They're finally doing something. They also took down, I think, the at HHS there was the last
The
Surgeon
Surgeon
General.
General's, yeah.
Yeah, and
Public
that.
health declaration of gun violence as a public health emergency, right?
Right, which was a big political move from the Biden administration in 2024, and so they undid that. It's they appear to they still haven't like publicly confirmed this, but it certainly appears that they've gotten rid of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention at the White House. And you know, those are some turnkey things, and it's like they could have done this day one, like they did a bunch of other stuff, and they didn't. That doesn't mean they're not going to do it. So I try to, like, at least for me, I try to keep focused on what's actually happening and what's not happening. And I don't. You can criticize for not moving fast enough or something like that, but I don't want to go out on limbs and say, oh, they're not going to do this or that just because it hasn't happened yet. We're still pretty early in this thing. I know it's been moving very fast and they've been very aggressive, but
Right. Well, and I
it's
think that's
60
the,
days or whatever.
yeah, I mean, and I think that's part of the issue, right? Is that we see this wrecking ball being taken to, you know, the federal infrastructure in so many of these agencies. And I think there is that thought, okay, like, why isn't this happening to the ATF, right? Why aren't we seeing these rules just, you know, get smashed to bits with a sledgehammer? And I think it is fair to say that this is not as much of a priority as dealing with illegal immigration. As you know, we're trying to get peace in Ukraine, and you know, frankly, I mean, I hate to say it, but not only is that probably not a top priority for the administration, this is probably not a top priority for Republicans in general, especially you know, again, compared to illegal immigration. Like, is it an issue? Absolutely, it is. But is it as important to most Republican voters as deporting violent illegal immigrants? Probably not. Right. And so I think that some of this might be the Trump administration looking and saying, well, what's most important to our base? What's most important to our voters? You know, what are they wanting us to do first and prioritize? And I think maybe that's they're following suit.
And look, it doesn't matter what you think about the other what they're doing in other areas, right? Like you could dislike it, or you could like it, or you could dislike the approach they've taken, or whatever. It's just more about clearly there's a this is down the totem pole of issues for the Trump administration, and you can judge them based on that fact alone. You know, it's fair to make judgments off of that, but you know, I don't what I wouldn't do is go out and say because it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen. And you know, and look, they kind of telegraphed this idea that it's not at the top of their priority list throughout the campaign. This was not something that they focused on at all, right? Like this is, and it's continued to be that way. You know, his acceptance speech at the RNC, longest in history, didn't mention gun policy once. His first speech to Congress here in his second term, longest in history, didn't mention gun policy once. So, like, it's not, it's fair to take away from all of this that guns are a low priority issue, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that that gun rights activists aren't going to see what they're hoping to see out of this.
Yeah, I
Will
think
they
that's
get
right.
everything? I don't know, but.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, you know, wrote something about is the Trump's administration's policy on guns like one of benign neglect? Basically, like we're not going to do anything to harm you, but we're really not going to. We're just going to deal with it. And I don't think that that's quite accurate, because I mean, again, you look at the appointment of Kash Patel as the acting ATF director. You look at the appointment of Robert Leiter as the general counsel.
Yeah,
These are
lighter
all
especially.
substantially good moves, right, for gun owners. And maybe again, once you've got that team in place, like I certainly hope that Professor Leiter, or I guess Assistant Director Leiter, or both, is going to take a hands-on approach here, and he's got the background and he's got the expertise to say, okay, here's how we can wind back some of these rules, and here's how we go forward with, ensuring that there's a working relationship between the firearms industry and the ATF, and not this combative relationship that Biden wanted to have. And as you say, we really are early on in this administration. It has only been a couple of months. I know for a lot of people, it may seem like every day is a year, but it really has not been that long. And we are seeing some good moves. I just,
And I don't want to overstate that, like, this is not a major thing what they did today. It's a plan for a plan,
yeah.
but it is movement.
Let's put it this way. It may not be a major thing, but it's more than has been done in 30 years,
Sure, yeah, on this issue,
right?
yeah,
On this
certainly.
issue. So, again, I mean, you talk about this. I agree that this is, restoration of rights is not probably the top issue for most gun owners, but I can tell you, I've talked just in the past couple of months, I've been having some work done around the house, and a couple of the guys that I've hired have been very open about the fact, we talk about what I do for a living, because they're wondering, like, why do you just get to hang out at your house all day? And I said, well, I'm not just hanging out, I'm working. And a couple of these guys have, they have felony convictions in their past. One of them was a nonviolent drug conviction. One of them was, I think, a violent felony conviction that was something like 25 years ago. These are guys who have stayed out of trouble with the law. They have built their own businesses, right? They are, by all accounts, upstanding members of the community. I have friends who are in the same boat. I have a friend who spent 5.5 years in federal prison for cocaine distribution when he was in his early 20s. He's now almost 40 years old. Again, owns his own business. He's a family man. He stays out of trouble. He's actually really good friends with one of the local sheriffs around here, but he can't touch a gun. He can't touch a round of ammunition, or he goes to prison. So I understand, there are going to be real individuals. This isn't just a hypothetical situation. There are going to be real individuals who hopefully will benefit from this move. But there are also going to be a lot of FFLs who would benefit, as you say, to an end to that zero tolerance policy, right? There are going to be a lot of gun owners who would benefit from a repeal of the engaged in the business rule that says if you even offer a gun for sale, even if that sale doesn't get completed, we might consider you to be an unlicensed gun dealer, and we might, send you to federal prison. So there is a lot of work to be done on these issues. And again, my hope is that now that we're starting to see this team put in place, that maybe the ball will start rolling a little bit faster.
Yeah, and look, even if Trump isn't, or Elon Musk, or the people who are kind of at the center of a lot of this aggressive movement in other areas, even if they don't have this as a top priority, if they put the people in place like Leiter, who do care about this issue, and have put them in positions where they can affect change, that might not matter that Trump isn't focused on it. You know what I mean?
Right, because you've delegated that authority and that responsibility to people who do and who will make this a priority, ideally, right?
Right, and that's the other, and that's why it's more reasonable now, especially with the appointment of Leiter. But that you've seen this rule come out, and that's something, and then Leiter going in, it's more reasonable to think yes, they probably are going to go through with undoing the Biden administration era rules, and then maybe even pushing forward on some of their own rules that we might not, it might not be something that you've has been at the center of attention, but could, they could come up with interesting creative solutions to getting some stuff that gun rights advocates have wanted for years. Now rulemaking is a as we're talking about here, just undoing all the stuff that Biden did through rulemaking. Rulemaking is not as permanent as lawmaking,
Right.
and there's it's much more limited in what you can do, but there's a lot of opportunity there, I think. And with Leiter being in, that really sends a signal to me that like the stuff that you think could happen probably will happen.
Yeah, I agree. Again, steps are being taken. I mean, not at a maybe not at lightning speed, but I think steps are being taken in the right direction. And as you kind of alluded to, Steve, I will be on the Weekly Reload podcast, which is going to air when? When can folks download that?
Members can get it on Sunday,
Okay.
as always. They get a day early, but everyone else, it'll be public on Monday. So we'll have an even more in-depth conversation, kind of taken off from where we've started here.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation. Folks can again check out the reload.com for all of Steven's reporting. Sign up to become a member, get that exclusive access, get the early access, the exclusive stories at thereload.com. And Stephen, I will be talking to you very soon to keep up this conversation.
I appreciate it.
My thanks to Stephen for joining us once again. And yeah, be sure to check out the Reload podcast on Sunday if you are a subscriber, or on Monday if you are not. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, which once again, I got to come up with a new name for this because lately we've had a lot of non-recidivists, but just really inappropriate sentences. But the inappropriate sentence report just doesn't really roll off the tongue, does it? So today's story from Las Vegas. Here's the headline. Former Las Vegas Metro Police officer sentenced to probation for child abuse and domestic violence. Now, this former officer was eligible for a 10-year prison sentence, but instead, Joseph Ortega has been sentenced to probation after being found guilty of destroying property, pointing a gun at his children, and engaging in, quote, excessive physical discipline. As KTNV reports, the incidents occurred in March of 2023. They came to light in October of that year during an unrelated investigation. The mother of Ortega's two children reported to police that he had been violent, smashing objects inside their home, and later terrifying the children by pointing a gun at them through a window. I got to tell you, as a father and as a gun owner, that makes me furious. No, he didn't pull the trigger, but any parent who would try to inflict terror on their children by pointing a gun at them or waving a knife at them or, again, threatening them in such a manner, that just ins I am incensed by that. Now, Ortega's defense attorney argued that Ortega was suffering from a psychological breakdown at the time of the incident. Ortega posted multiple videos on Facebook in the months following his trial, claiming that many of the allegations against him were false. But again, he apparently was found guilty of these crimes. Judge Kathleen Delaney, in his sentencing, said, "Focusing on the district attorney and the detectives and others as if somehow you, Mr. Ortega, are part of some great conspiracy in the city of Las Vegas to put you in prison, nothing could be further from the truth." And then I guess she belied that point by not putting him in prison. He was found guilty by a jury, and as KTNV reports, he faced the possibility of more than a decade behind bars, but instead, Judge Delaney sentenced him to nothing more than probation, although she placed several strict conditions on his release. He's going to have to undergo mental health counseling, which sounds like a great idea, anger management therapy, parenting courses, all probably pretty good idea. He also has to refrain from alcohol and marijuana use, has to maintain full-time employment. He'll also be subject to searches of his electronic devices to ensure compliance with the terms of his probation. He is barred from contacting his children except as permitted by family court. And as a KTNV report, should he violate any of the terms of his probation, he could still face time behind bars. Just Delaney said, "As of today, what's been going on until this point ends. And if it doesn't end, then you have made the choice to put yourself in prison." Well, I got to say, that remains to be seen, right? Because we've seen so many cases in the past where individuals who violate the terms of their probation do not get the entirety of their sentence imposed on them. They're sent to jail for maybe a couple of weeks, and they're told, "Don't do this again." And then if they violate their probation, it's this cycle of rinse and repeat. Now, I hope that none of that happens to Mr. Ortega. I hope that he takes the conditions of his probation seriously. I hope that he's able to get the counseling that he needs. I hope that one day, perhaps, he's able to rebuild a relationship with his children. If his kids want at this point, I don't know that I would want to have anything to do with one of my parents if they ever pointed a gun at me trying to scare me. But I'm not in the position of those kids. So, let's keep our fingers crossed that this is the last time we hear about Mr. Ortega on this program or elsewhere. All right, now on to today's armed citizen story, also from Las Vegas, oddly enough. The headline from the Las Vegas Sun: Northwest Las Vegas homicide submitted for self-defense review, according to police. So these have not officially been determined self-defense, but also no arrests have been made in these cases yet. So it certainly seems like there were strong indications that self-defense was behind both of these homicides. One happened on Tuesday night, around 9:22 p.m. Metropolitan Police Department got a call about a domestic disturbance. When officers went inside the home, they found a person suffering from an apparent gunshot wound, or I guess multiple gunshot wounds. Medical personnel pronounced the person at the scene, as deceased. 30-year-old Julius Rogers is his name. Homicide detectives took over the investigation, according to the Las Vegas Sun. And public information officer Bob Wicks, telling the Las Vegas Review-Journal, quote, after completing the preliminary investigation, the incident will be submitted to the DA's office for self-defense review. So, again, it appears that there are at least elements of self-defense there at the scene. Wicks also said that another homicide that happened this week in Northwest Las Vegas will also be submitted to the DA's office for self-defense review. In that case, a 52-year-old Shay Couillette was the deceased individual. Don't really have any information about the circumstances that led to that death, but we will keep our eyes on both of these cases because I expect that we will be hearing more information in the days to come. And finally today, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, some Good Samaritans in Kent, Washington, who helped save a kidnapping victim. Once again, an incident of a domestic nature here. So this was all started, I guess, at a shopping center. Police say last Friday, there were some witnesses who saw a woman being forcibly dragged into a vehicle. And they tried to stop this from happening, but they couldn't. He ended up taking off. They were able to get the license plate number. They called police. And 10 minutes later, the same car was spotted on a nearby street. When officers pulled the car over, they found a 22-year-old woman inside the vehicle, bruised, but not suffering from serious physical injuries. The driver, a 30-year-old man, unidentified at this point, was arrested at the scene. According to KIRO in Seattle, the victim told police that it was her boyfriend. They'd been together for about a year. They'd moved to Washington from another state. She had really no family or friends around to help her out. He is now facing charges of second-degree kidnapping. I don't know if he's facing any charges of domestic abuse, but he is facing criminal charges. And, you know, at the very least, I mean, we don't know how the situation would have escalated, but it certainly sounds like it may very well have continued, right? And at the very least, that has come to a stop. So we hope that she gets the help that she needs. And again, those Good Samaritans in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to help a stranger in need. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program once again. We'll be back on Monday. Fingers crossed we get some good news on the Snope case out of Maryland. It is being heard in conference today for the 8th time, I believe. You also have Ocean State Tactical versus Nerona. That is the challenge to Rhode Island's magazine ban. That's, I believe, been listed for the 9th time in conference. So we'll see if the 8th and 9th time are the charms for these critically important segment cases at SCOTUS. And we'll have much more for you on Monday's program as well. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com today, tomorrow, throughout the weekend. We'll keep you up to date on all the latest segment of news and information from across the nation. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP Gold, VIP, VIP Platinum member. You've got several levels to choose from. Use the promo code FIGHT and you can save 60% off of your membership. You'll get exclusive content at every level of support. But again, regardless of what level you choose, you will be supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing here at Bearing Arms and at Bearing Arms Gaming Company. We really, truly thank you for that. Have a great rest of your day. The music is gone, so I better disappear too. We'll see you back here soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.